What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. Would you call yourself sleep deprived? Have trouble getting to sleep on many nights? Well, you're not alone, clearly. But given the fact that nutrition, physical exercise, and sleep make up the troika of health guardrails, do not ignore your inability to get enough sleep. It's a real problem with real-world consequences. Our guest today has some simple steps to getting a better sleep. He's a lively and authoritative source on the subject. It was my pleasure to interview him. You'll enjoy it too. Stay tuned next here on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Dr. Abhinav Singh, and he's written a book that's very important for all of us. Truly, it is. And it's about the issue of sleep in our lives. And I know that, Dr. Singh, it's really become an issue for so many people, unable to fall asleep with all the worries of the world resting upon them. And I've got to ask you, how important an issue overall? I mean, I know a lot of people might kid about it or kind of get a little laugh or what have you, but this is serious stuff, is it not?
Very, very important. I think it's something that we are continuously underestimating and sacrificing all the time and trading for other activities and preferences. While I say that, I mean whether it's demands on your time, your social responsibilities, entertainment, the first and the softest target is sacrificing sleep. And it's probably the worst decision we make when we do that on a chronic basis, whether it's screens, whether it's work with the pandemic teaching us to work from home and work home boundaries became blurred, laptops reaching the bedroom, the bed, screens everywhere. And sleep is fundamental to health. And we continue to sacrifice it and trade it like no other, you know. And we have a finite amount of life, finite amount of sleep, and all kinds of health problems are surfacing now.
I mean, I know people throughout the course of my life, I've always needed about 7 hours a night to feel whole. And oftentimes, as I get older, a little bit of a nap, and we can talk about that. But I know these people who tell me that they have historically gotten 3 or 4 hours sleep every night, and they can function. That seems so difficult for me.
I agree with you. I think function and optimal function are separate. 3 or 4 hours of sleep and then optimal function is scientifically very, very difficult. There is a very, very small subset of people who may have a mutation that can allow them to sleep for a hair under 6 hours and function normally. But for us humans, 7 to 9 hours is what the recommended amount of sleep is. And anybody who's getting that number in terms of much lesser sleep than 7 to 9 hours and feels that they're okay must ask themselves these three basic questions. Number one, how much caffeine do you consume through the day to make your day function well? Number two, what does your sleep look like on the weekend? Do you catch up 2 or 3 extra hours? That quickly tells you that whatever they're getting in the week is not enough and they compensate on their non-work days. And number three, when they have a stopping moment, can they quickly doze off if they were given the opportunity? Those three questions are easy questions to know and ask for one to figure out whether the hours of sleep they're getting are enough, truly, or are they compensating?
What about those who say to us, and we hear this all the time, I really have trouble getting to sleep. And so the question is, what do you do about it? I mean, is it really insomnia, or is it just that your habits around bedtime may not be as quieting as they need to be? Should you, if you can't get to sleep, should you get up and try something, or should you just lie there and hope that you can get to sleep? I know a lot of people are using aids today, like melatonin. So get into all of that. The person who has trouble sleeping.
Yes. Chronic difficulties with sleep, defined as a hard time falling asleep, hard time staying asleep for more than 3 nights a week, for more than 3 months, equal to chronic insomnia by definition. And there are a few other nuances of this definition as well in terms of daytime impact and waking up before the alarm or waking up before your desired wake-up time. Now, once you've defined insomnia, it starts off at some point in life with some stressful event, be it a job change, a loss of spouse, financial stress, the pandemic did it to many. All of this can spark off the worrying brain to spin more at night or in the evening hours when it's bedtime. Then you add to that screens. Then you add to that the effort of trying to sleep. And I'm reminded of a favorite line of mine by Daniel Erickson, a sleep physician out on the East Coast. He says, no one sleeps better by trying harder. Think about it, right? The harder you try, the worse it gets. It's like chasing a butterfly. I use this example when I educate patients. Secondly, when you struggle and you struggle again and you struggle again the subsequent night, guess what? You're getting good at something. The behavior of struggle is you're getting good at that. Number three, if you do have a hard time falling and staying asleep, it's best to bring this up with someone, a trained healthcare professional, because like I said, chronic sleep loss is probably one of the most dangerous things you can do to yourself, and it can hurt every aspect of your health. Supplements. You mentioned melatonin. You know, funny thing, I just did a review today on this, and melatonin is actually a hormone, just like your thyroid, just like your testosterone, just like your insulin. It's a hormone, and it regulates your circadian rhythms in the body. And circadian rhythms are just not sleep and wake. Every organ system has a circadian rhythm of functioning and resting, and they all synchronize with melatonin. So it's just not sleep and wake. That's when people use it in the U.S. as a dietary supplement. That's how it's classified. It has its sort of risks if used in high doses for long periods of time. As we are learning about it, it can have impact into other systems as well. Hmm. We're looking at, you know, young adults reaching puberty sooner. There are some newer papers, small papers that are coming out. More research needs to be done. We're looking at its impact on insulin, glucose metabolism. There may be an impact there. So we have to be a little careful. In Australia, for example, melatonin is prescription. Parts of Europe, it's behind the counter. You just can't go buy it as a dietary supplement. I mean, as strict as we are in the U.S., I am surprised that melatonin is so easily available. And we need to rethink that, I feel, especially for our young ones. There's a paper out just, I think, last week that says 44% of parents are using melatonin in their children group. That's a high number. It's telling you that nearly half of them are having sleep issues.
That's surprising. I mean, I use it. I'm going to tell you how I use it. When I have something, you know, now I'm kind of what I call casually employed, which is another way to say almost retired, and doing the podcast and a million other things. But once in a while, I have to get up early in the morning and really undertake a lot of responsibilities, and I have meetings or trips or whatever. I will take melatonin on those occasions just to make sure that I get a good night's sleep and that I'm ready for the next day. But I don't use it every night. Is there any rule of thumb about using it?
I feel that's probably, as much as we know scientifically, it's probably okay to do because it's sparing. It's with a purpose. And you give yourself the 7-8 hours and you're not on it in terms of nightly as well as with escalating doses. So that, I feel, should be okay for now. And there is no clear rule of thumb. The one that I love to use is don't sleep on your sleep issues. If anything becomes chronic or is becoming chronic, don't try to DIY this. Because guess what? Sleep is a third of your life. And it really is the foundation of health. I would upgrade it from a pillar, because people say, oh, sleep is the third pillar of health. So let's look at it. It's like exercise, nutrition, and sleep. And so I would say if I gave you the best exercise plan, the best nutrition, and I gave you the worst sleep, do you think you'll be able to reap just as much benefit from your exercise and nutrition on the background of very poor sleep?
Yeah, that's a great point to make. The other thing that I hear time and again from friends of mine, and more often as I get older, people who have sleep apnea, and they're doing all kinds of things. They're wearing all kinds of contraptions. Now we see that there's some kind of surgical remedy. I mean, how common is sleep apnea? And explain how difficult a circumstance that is to either overcome or to live with.
Let's unpack that. So you're asking how common is sleep apnea?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So snoring, breathing pauses, and having oxygen drops and sleep qualitative disruptions over and over all night long is equal to sleep apnea. It has lots of impact. Every aspect of your health, cardiovascular, hypertension, stroke risk, dry mouth, bathroom breaks at night, ED, sexual dysfunction, irritability, anxiety, focus deficit, memory, traffic accidents, poor quality of life, shortened lifespan. I mean, I can rattle off more. Sleep apnea is something that goes unnoticed. And the funny thing is, it's actually quite audible, and yet it gets slept on. You know what I'm saying? So the individual who suffers from sleep apnea doesn't know, doesn't acknowledge, remains in denial, gets what I call, I write about this in the book, it's called the ouch versus couch treatment, and they still don't want to acknowledge. Finally, they show up at the doctor's because something has happened, hopefully not a serious cardiovascular event. How common is this? We estimate that moderate sleep apnea, not even talking mild, right? Forget snoring. We're not talking snoring here. We're talking snoring coupled with breathing collapses, coupled with choking, coupled with oxygen drops for at least 10 seconds at a time, for at least 15 times an hour is defined as moderate sleep apnea. More than 30 times an hour we call severe sleep apnea. If you look at moderate and severe, you're looking at upwards of 25 million adults plus. If you include the milder cases as well, now you're talking almost a sixth of the population, almost like 50 million adults, of which only 20% are actually diagnosed. And of the diagnosed, only a fifth are actually well treated. These are academy numbers. And so it's very much out there and very much untreated or suboptimally diagnosed and treated. And it can cause all kinds of problems, health issues. And it's very expensive as a society to have sleep apnea left untreated.
Very important information. Dr. Abhinav Singh is with us. He's written a book called Sleep to Heal, 7 Simple Steps to Better Sleep. We will get into them, but I do encourage you, of course, to get the book because it is an important aid along with all the other things that you might be doing if you're having difficulty sleeping. When should we get to a clinic to really be analyzed, and how important is that? I've talked to people who've done it, and they thought it was a really important thing for them to do. Today, it's been augmented with digital sleep health coaches. So tell us, when you talk about the fact, don't sleep on it, you mean get some real professional help. Tell us what that looks like and what we should be looking to find when we are out there seeking this kind of advice.
Because it's a third of your life and has so much impact, and it's really, it's like your entire health warranty plan. Like, this is your maintenance plan. And why would you compromise on that is how I start my pitch here. So if you wake up frequently and feel, still tired, still not myself, then it's time to bring this up. And bring it up starting with your primary care doc. From there, if you need a sleep specialist to further evaluate, take it there. There are board certified sleep specialists who can help. Whether it requires a sleep study or just an evaluation of your sleep routine, start there. Let them take it further. Because if you keep delaying and waiting for the consequences to happen, some of those health impacts are difficult to undo. Heart attacks, for example, strokes, for example, traffic accidents, you know, because of poor quality of sleep, leaving you sleepy and less attentive in the daytime. Also, discord, you know, relationship discord. I mean, so I keep counting on. So I would say if you find yourself frequently struggling in the morning when you get up and think like, oh, man, I just haven't had a good night's rest in a while. Say something.
Now, because this has become a part of the modern lexicon, people talking about their sleep, there is much more acknowledgement today of its importance. Having said that, you know, doctor, what happens in America. Nothing succeeds like excess. So when you do have an issue, everybody wants to profiteer and they want to promote themselves. Now, I went to get a new bed several years ago, and I was introduced to a sleep clinician, which is basically a salesman at a furniture store who dresses in a white coat.
Oh, my.
But then they have all of this gadgetry that tries to measure, you know, various positioning and this, that, and the other. I mean, how should we look at that? Because, yes, we want to be mindful of, you know, really having this sleep that we need to function and to perform well, but we don't want to be taken advantage of.
We have to get out of our own way. You're absolutely right. We are addicts to convenience in this. I call it the curse of affluence. This part of the world that we live in, very blessed to be here. However, we have a problem. We are cursed in terms of with the addiction to convenience, right? So straight up front, there is no scientific study, peer-reviewed, published, that says that a mattress or a pillow is better than B pillow for improved sleep or quality of such. Okay, so nothing out there yet. Second, whatever works for your body type and posture, and hopefully, you know, if you have any joint ailments in your neck and spine, comfort is a subjective decision. There is no objective measure. It's a personal decision, like comfort. Like you like blue, I like green. Is blue better than green? No. Is green better than blue? No. It's just what helps you feel and sleep better. Third, there is science to say that if the room is cooler, it may support sleep. A hotter environment is more interfering with sleep, and that's one thing. So when we talk about mattress pads that are breathable and cotton sheets that are breathable and some cooling things, there may be some scientific / theoretical advantage, again, not tested in the lab, in a broader scale tests and published. Fourth, you have all these wearables, nearables. Yes, they are churning out some sleep data, but sleep is really a brainwave signature as well as is you, the individual, feeling it, right? So you know, you don't need a gadget to tell you that you're feeling good after a good night's rest. Isn't that true? It is, isn't it?
Well, it is. And, you know, this bed that we bought has a sleep tracker on it to tell you when you've had this amount of REM sleep, how many hours, the lighter sleep. When we do have those kinds of indicators available to us, how should we read those?
So these things are getting better, but they're far from it. It's like me giving you a cup of coffee with some cream and sugar and saying, hey, have a sip. Okay, how much cream, how much sugar, how much coffee? And you throw some numbers out. And that's the kind of level of accuracy we are at right now. But they are getting better. So if they say REM sleep is rapid eye movement sleep. These things, devices are measuring that by maybe heart rate, maybe body temperature, and maybe movement. No brainwave signature. And that's where the problem lies, right? So they are getting better, but I wouldn't hang my hat on them. Now, consistently, if you see a particular pattern on those trackers, say something, get in touch with a specialist and have them evaluate your sleep and take it from there. Not start to DIY things. Like, do you DIY chest pain? Do you DIY diabetes? No, right? Why would you DIY sleep issues, which basically are 33% of your existence? That your 2/3 of your existence relies on this. I wouldn't DIY this. Yes, these are useful. Yes, they start the conversation, but take it to a professional and let them take it from there. I do support them. I believe in them. I wear one, but I take it for what it is.
What about positioning during sleep? I mean, there are some of us who are decidedly side sleepers. I'm definitely a side sleeper. Others who sleep on their back, others who sleep on their stomach. Is there anything about the positioning that you suggest we should be aware of?
So positioning is important, for most importantly for comfort. And certain people have certain, say, acid reflux. You know, certain postures will help people with who get nocturnal reflux. Snorers may get relief with side sleep better than sleeping on their back. So you'll often see the spouse will give you a little nudge to move over. It's called, I call it the Abhinav Singh's ouch versus couch test. You know, so if you're getting elbows and you're getting enough of them to go to the couch, it's time to say something to your doc. So yeah, so certain postures, if you have neck issues, you can have the head of the bed, you know, a certain way. If you have reflux, snoring, we talked about. Pregnant women like to sleep on the sides more. But again, if you wake up with no shoulder pain, no neck pain, everybody will change postures through the night. Almost 20 plus times, believe it or not, you will change postures. You may like a posture, but I can sign it and bet $20 that you will change your posture as a healthy person about 20 times a night, and it's fine. You may not feel it, you may not remember it, but you will. And that's normal for all the parts to not get too squished for too long.
What about the pillow? I have to ask about that. Yeah. I don't want to promote a certain pillow company, believe me.
But neither do I.
But my question is, what about the importance of that? Because my wife and I have attempted to try lots of different pillows to find that perfect magical feel. And I don't know that we've done it as of yet.
Again, it's your neck, your head circumference. As long as the pillow can have some heat loss or some kind of, it can keep your skull cool and it's comfortable for your neck, that pillow is great. And firmness, softness, angle, it's really all about personal taste. Again, I go back to my line saying there's no documented established study that says, yes, this pillow is fantastic versus not.
I've got to ask you, because I'm trying to think of the things that anyone listening to this podcast would want to know about. Let's take a person who's got a new job and it's on a different clock. And that's a difficult thing. There are the shift workers, of course, and they change. So say you go from a 7 to 3 to a 3 to 11 shift. How do you acclimate to that and the whole issue of darkness and having that quietude? Or if you've always been somebody who slept at a normal time, say 10 at night till 6 in the morning, and then your shift changed, what should you do to acclimate to that?
So it's like self-inflicted jet lag, right? So when you travel out west or east, your body takes about a day per hour to actually acclimate fully from a circadian rhythm standpoint to the new place. Now you can help this or hurt this by certain activities, namely sunlight exposure, sunlight avoidance, and maybe some melatonin supplementation. So when you say travel out west, it's 3 hours. I'm in the Eastern time zone here in Indianapolis. So if we go west to LA, it's 3 hours behind us. So when I go there and I'm feeling hungry at 4 p.m. for dinner, because that's what my body is signaling, right? Because in India, it's 7 p.m. Mm. So, but slowly over the course of a week, that'll acclimate to the LA time zone. Now, back to your question where you suddenly change shifts, it's very challenging for the certain shift workers if you start to go from first, second, or third shift. And I have several patients who undergo this. So night shift is generally to acclimate from morning to night shift is generally easier because you're delaying your sort of sleep onset. Again, I'm saying easy and it's in quotes here and has a lot of qualification to it. So you're having to stay up all day and then all night. And then you come home after your night shift is done and you fall asleep in the day as much as you can. So that requires some discipline. So sleeping in the daytime is against our natural design. So if you come home at 7 a.m., darkened curtains, you know, light blocking eye shades over your eyes, maybe even some white noise to block any interruptions from the noises outside the home or your living area, and then giving yourself 6+ hours of uninterrupted sleep at least to then be up at 2 or 3 in the afternoon to continue for that third shift. And then the problem becomes when you're off work and then you have to suddenly match the world time clock again, yeah, which is a total challenge. So I really feel for these folks. And yeah, they say keep your regular schedule as much as you can, but it's hard. and it takes a toll on the body. And the advice is, like I said, if you need help with staying awake during your work shift, talk to a doc. We call it shift work disorder. And if you need falling asleep when you're off shift and you're having a hard time, that's again insomnia from shift work. We can help with that. But getting into a regular shift and not switching it back and forth is probably the advice, which is theoretical, but it's hard to practically follow. It's a challenge for these souls. I've been there myself as a physician, working nights, evenings, call coverage, 24-hour shifts, 36-hour shifts, and I feel for them, and I don't miss those days at all.
What about white noise and apps now that calm you? I mean, how important are those as adjuncts or in lieu of people taking either prescription medication or melatonin or what have you?
So to start off, you know, white noise or any ambient noise to block any other stimulation is reasonable. A lot of phones have that. Make sure they're not too loud. Hopefully they're on a timer so they can switch off after a while if they help you with sleep onset. But if they get too loud, like for children especially, right, people have these noise machines that sometimes get very harsh, very loud. And so you have to look at that, right? Are you opening up a door of some ear damage down the road? Most likely not, but something to consider. No big trials on this yet. Second, for use for people, it will definitely not replace prescription meds, because by the time you've reached prescription meds, your insomnia has really become a defined diagnosis, and it'll require more supervised behavioral therapies and short-term prescription therapies to recalibrate and, you know, get the solutions to the insomnia and have you back to sleeping again. But short-term usages of those calming noises, maybe some meditative lectures, I recommend people can hear them and they fade off after, you know, 5, 10, 20 minutes and hopefully help people sleep.
Yeah, play-by-play of baseball is pretty good because it's so slow. Let me ask you about the alone together thing. A lot of couples may be listening together in the car, and maybe you have trouble because your partner is all over the bed or is not able to get as restful a sleep. I know it does bother me at times when we both go into bed at the same time, and I can tell she's asleep a lot sooner than I am. So what do you say to couples who are dealing with this issue?
So Wendy Troxell from the East Coast, I think RAND Corporation, did a wonderful paper. She's done some papers on this, that it's okay. You know, you can reserve time for intimacy, share the bed, and if sleeping in separate sleeping arrangements helps each of you sleep better, it shouldn't be looked at as a negative or a minus point. Because then, remember, if one person's restless, it's two people's sleep sacrifice, right? Because that person will hurt the other person's sleep, because it'll wake the other person up. Secondly, if one person's snoring, then two people's sleep is lost, because this partner has to suffer through them. If one person's restless and has a hard time falling asleep and sees the other person hit the pillow and gone, then it aggravates the other partner who's having a hard time. So I'm all for both people sleeping, right? So if one person is not sleeping well, the whole house is suffering. Why should it be like that? So yes, you can sleep in separate environments, make sure it doesn't, you know, hurt your relationship, reserve time for intimacy and being together. And I'm okay with that. I don't mind that. I don't see it as a large negative, as long as they understand what this is for.
I've been reading about breathing fragrances while sleeping boosts memory and learning. Is there anything scientifically valid or empirical about that?
I haven't seen it. I've seen some aromatherapy equal to relaxation, sort of feelings of relaxation. I've not seen larger studies that say they promote sleep or reduce time to fall asleep. So I wouldn't say that they can boost memory and learning. I think that's a far-fetched hope at this point. And I do wish people study this in detail. But right now, I haven't seen anything.
Now, let me ask you for a couple of the ideas in your book, Sleep to Heal, 7 Simple Steps to Better Sleep. Give us one or two or three that you don't mind giving away. We want people to go get this book. It is really important because it affects, as you say, time and again and so eloquently, one-third of your living life. So tell us Give us, you know, what you think are the most important of these steps.
I think routine and ritual, right? So the entire body is a rhythm, and one must understand that. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday is a creation by man. Right? The body doesn't know Sunday from Monday. It really doesn't. And just like your puppy doesn't know, you know, just like your cat doesn't know. They don't know this because their world doesn't have these. We've created these. So now, I would love to preach consistency as much as possible. And I understand that in practicality, this is tough, but try. You know, you got to, you'll never get there unless you even try. So I call it like have a ritual that's 30 minutes to 45 minutes long. And I even work with, you know, the professional basketball team, the NBA. And I talk about this, like consistency is important. So I have this thing that I carved out and I simplified into this thing called the foreplay method. And it really, it helps. So you dedicate 10 minutes to a routine, which could be stretching, shower, a little journal, reading a book, unwinding away from screens, breathing routine, just, and then just planning your, sort of unwinding the day mentally in your head. So shower, journal, read, breathe is like a simple four-step method you can pick from that list and do it over and over and over again. Every night before you sleep, whether you're stressed, whether you're not, just keep doing it. And it forms this Pavlovian response in patients and in people, myself included, which signals sleep. So it teaches you. If you remember the famous Pavlovian experiment where he rang a bell, called the dog's name and put food out, and he just did it for 3 weeks, right? The scientist Pavlov. And guess what? After that, the dog would hear the bell at any time of day, the same bell tone. His tongue would be out and salivating and ready to expect food and love. So you can, and it took 3 weeks. So this is so powerful. So if you condition yourself, even if you don't have a problem, right? So if you make a good habit stronger, then the bad habit or the disruptions have a much harder time taking place and disrupting your sleep. So that's what I got. I think that's one little, I love this and I stand behind it. But it takes a bit, 3 to 4 weeks to make a habit, 3 to 4 weeks to break a habit. There you go. In about 6 weeks, if you did this correctly, high likelihood that you'll improve from where you are.
Okay. In closing, naps. As we get older, we like to take them. Should we limit them to 20 minutes? What's the logic there?
So short naps are great if timed with your natural circadian lull, which is between 1 and 3. 20 minutes, all of us, just before your call, I actually laid down in my office and I shut my eyes for about 9 minutes just to relax and unwind. I didn't fall asleep, but it just helps me refresh, recharge, and revitalize. All of us feel that. If we did it, you know how, you can tell the difference. NASA has proved it. They've done their science. It works. Short naps work. And I don't like the word nap as much. I don't know. We have to find a new term for this. Nap almost puts the pressure on you to fall asleep. And you may not fall asleep. You may just have a wind down, relaxing time, eyes closed, reducing stimulation in the brain, a rest period. Then you talk about elderly, and as we age, we feel like we need to nap. Correct. So as we age, we don't need less sleep. We get less sleep from a variety of reasons. Health issues, bathroom breaks at night, disruptions for men, menopause for women, medications. All of these things can sort of eat into your sleep and give your, what used to be a nonstop flight, now have 2 stops in there, right?
Yeah.
So now, you almost feel like you're half hour short, 1 hour short. And many times, you know, folks in your privileged position are casually employed or almost retired. So they have the luxury of time. They don't have to be somewhere at 7 a.m., 8 a.m. So they can afford an hour of a nap. And if it doesn't hurt their nighttime sleep, and they can still sleep, you know, almost 7 hours, in one go, 6 to 7 hours, I'm okay with a nap. As long as it's not to compensate for lack of sleep and it's not because you're so sleepy, overwhelmingly sleepy in the day and they're not able to get by the day without this long nap, I'm okay as long as it's not interfering with their daytime activities and their nighttime sleep.
You've given us such great information. In closing, sleep's impact on lifespan. Because if people really want to pay off, and you can tell us that better sleep means perhaps a longer, healthier life. Help us to unpack this.
You know, and this is probably an example that people shouldn't go away thinking, oh my God, did he just say that? And here is my, I love this line, and it came out at an evening event, that, you know, sleep can make the difference between whether one ages like fine whiskey in value or yogurt, a box of open yogurt kept outside on your kitchen countertop. So that's the difference. Like, as so now, it doesn't mean I don't want people to go home and start drinking whiskey for sleep. That's not what I'm saying. I mean, it'll make you age like fine whiskey, which gets valuable with time. You know, it gets better and better and better with time. And so if you slept well, you will allow your body to take care of itself, heal well, because guess what? It knows how to do it. And sleep is when we can get out of our way and let nature help us manage the design that is so magnificent, what we call human body and the health. And guess what? Sleep to heal comes from the fact that health, you know, the word heal is 60% of health. H-E-A-L and H-E-A-L-T-H. That's it, right? So, yeah. And sleep is the most potent healer that I have known as a 20-year, you know, doing this, and as a medical professional for almost 25 years now.
Well, I can tell your patients must really love you. You're a great communicator. I'm sure a great doctor. Dr. Abhinav Singh, I can't thank you enough. The book is called Sleep to Heal, 7 Simple Steps to Better Sleep. Thank you so much for being with us today here on America Trends.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.